Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today we bring to you a program that features all American everything. So it's our all American program.
It's an all American program. It's a little lopsided.
But you'll
hear that as we go along.
Yeah.
There's a lot of cheese. It turns out there's a lot about American made cheese that's there to celebrate.
So, it certainly is.
And so we're bringing you that to begin with. And
that's Greg O'Neill from the American Cheese Society.
Yeah, what better person to lead off this whole thing? And here he is.
The American Cheese Society has a great reputation and does good work. And it's been around for, it's getting to be a while now. And we're talking here to the CS President Greg O'Neill. Greg, I was just actually reading an issue of Specialty Food News, which was rehashing how it was all founded in, was it 1980-something by Allison?
1983 in Cornell University, first just a handful of people coming together, and 31 years later we're a pretty large representative organization of cheese in the Americas, and really it's a vertical organization that is both right from producer through to consumer.
And the mission of the organization now, has it changed from when Allison and who was it founded it?
There was a professor at Cornell who was the Frank Kazakowski. He was one of the founding members, and there were a lot of cheesemakers. I think Allison Hooper and a bunch of other folks, Judy Shad from Capriole in Indiana. There was a number of producers who have all been around for that whole time. And the organization has morphed from being more of a PTA type of organization to being an industry organization that is also an advocate for, you know, cheesemakers and cheese in the Americas. And as things are happening in our industry that require us to step up, we've made the decision jointly that we needed to step up from being a cheerleader to being an advocate.
Okay, so that is a difference in your mission.
It is, but the center of the wheel is still cheesemaker. And the producer, you know, the producer and their product, that has always been the focus. And without the cheesemaker and their products, nothing else exists in our world. So, it's also gotten more complex over the last few years, especially with all the food safety issues and regulatory issues that are afoot.
But now you're the president, but you're certainly not the cheesemaker. You have a cheese business.
Yes.
Involved in moving cheese. So are you the first non-cheesemaker to be the president?
I'm not the first non-cheesemaker to be president. We have about the largest portion of our membership is cheesemakers, but the second largest portion is retailers, and I'm that. I am actually, to clarify, I am the immediate past president of the organization.
Yeah,
I'm the chairman of the board currently. Our current president is Peggy Smith, who is the co-founder of Cowgirl Creamery in California.
Yeah, we've interviewed Peggy.
Yeah, she's a lovely lady, and she wears many hats because Cowgirl is a producer. They're also a retailer,
yeah,
and they're also a distributor. So she wears three hats.
Busy girl, yeah.
Yes, she is, and well, it's great because she can bring perspective to industry issues that many others can't because she wears those different hats every day.
But the thing that's been happening consistently, year over year over year, is the improvement in the quality and the range of cheeses made in America. Now, how did that happen?
Well, it's interesting you say that. The quality, you know, our judging and competition is very unique in that it is both an aesthetic judging and a technical judging. And so many of the competitions out there in the world are just technical merit. So we have, you know, the technical starts at 50 and then you get the merits down. And aesthetic starts with 0 and builds up.
Oh, nice.
And a perfect score is 100. The average score has been going up over the course of years, and there were a couple of cheeses this year that achieved 100, which hardly ever happens. And
can you name those?
I don't know the exact ones that achieved them because it was Then they got into the finals. I was told by the heads of judging and competition this year that there were 9 or 10 cheeses that could have easily been best in show, and that's a great situation to have.
Oh, yes. Now, when you say America's plural, are you talking about beyond the United States?
Yes. Our membership has traditionally been North America, so Canada. We had, in fact, in 2011, we had our annual conference in Montreal, also Mexico. But anybody who is in Central America or South America can also enter their cheeses into the competition, and they can also be a member. So we are the Americas, but primarily our membership is United States and Canada.
I was referencing not just the United States, but also the remarkable success that's been achieved by American cheeses in world competitions.
You're absolutely correct. Many of our cheeses are winning in the London World Cheese Awards. We were fortunate enough to have attended the Slow Food World Cheese Festival in Italy, in Piemonte, last September, and the American cheeses that were on display and being sold they sold out in a record time. People just loved them, and there was a lot of interest in them. And so people were trying them, they were buying them, and I think almost all of them sold out even a day before the festival was over.
Wow, that's something.
And they brought 20% more cheese than they did the last time it was held. It's held every 2 years. So they had success over the course of the various times it's been held. So they said, okay, well, we'll bring more cheese this time. And they still sold out a day before the festival was over.
Now, can you explain how this is happening?
Well, I think what people are realizing is a lot of what's happening in the United States in cheese making, there's a lot of creativity and a lot of approaches to traditional cheese making that are not even being done as much in four-barrel markets like parts of Europe. The artisan cheese community in the United States is strong, it's young, and interestingly, we have, at our annual conference that we just had in Sacramento, I looked around and we had people attending from Italy and France and Belgium and UK and Germany and New Zealand and Australia. They're coming to our conference because there's nothing like it in the world.
Now, why is it? I mean, what differentiates it?
Well, what we have is we come together as an entire industry, and there's an educational aspect of it, there is a networking aspect of it, but there's also around safety and methods and excellence. We have programs designed to bring everybody up. We call it Cheese Camp or Cheese U. People come there and recharge their batteries, learn things. We have, we have really strong educational programs, and we help people. There's a lot of people who come to our conference to learn how to either start becoming a cheesemaker or a retailer and kind of make the connections they need in order to get off on the right foot.
Yeah, I mean, the Slow Food Pittsburgh sent 2 representatives to try to, and boy, did they come back fired up.
Well, I'll tell you something. It's not inexpensive for people to get away during the middle of their summer. A lot of people are, it's difficult to step away, but people go because a lot of them feel like it's the best time they spend in the year in the industry. There are a lot of trade shows, but this is something that's more personal and it's more central to what we do.
Now, how many applicants, entrants, do you have for the competition?
This year, we changed some of the rules in the categories. So it was about 1,700 cheeses. The year before, it was about 1,800, but because we did some classification changes, that came down. But it has varied between 1,600 and 1,900 cheeses every year, and they're across many hundreds, well over 100 categories. And it's pretty interesting because it's not companies, large companies and small companies enter, and sometimes you have, a gold or a blue ribbon, I should say, going to a small one, and then the silver might go to a larger company. But it's we don't look at it that way. We look at it as it's all judged blindly, and there's a lot of quality and a lot of variety.
Are there current trends in American cheese making that you could identify?
Well, some of the trends that I see happening is there's a lot of mixed milk cheese being made now.
Yeah, I've noticed that too, actually.
So a lot
One
of
your winners, actually, as combined, what is it?
Well, there's a practical aspect of that, and then there's also a creative aspect of that. The practical aspect of it is that especially in big dairy states where they have support for cow's milk production cheeses because of a large dairy, some of the people who make sheep's milk cheese or goat's milk cheese, they will get supported by those programs if they make a mixed milk cheese that employs cow's milk and their sheep's milk or their goat's milk. So there has been a little bit of that, but also we found that it adds nuance of flavor,
right.
And there are some amazing new American original cheeses that are being made that show kind of the breadth and depth of what can be done.
Yeah, we interviewed the guys from Dough Run Farm, which...
Oh, sure, in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and they've been mixing cow and sheep, and now they're going to add goat next year. And they're interested in the creative aspects of it.
Yeah, I think the creative aspect is what's driving it, but there are also benefits in certain places, in like California and Wisconsin, where they have a very established dairy marketing, and then they get the support by doing the mixed milk as well.
Okay, well that's pretty smart. I mean, you have to do what you have to do to stay in the game or get bigger.
Yeah.
Well, people don't get into the cheese industry to get rich.
That's for sure.
The running joke is, how to make a small fortune in cheese. Start with a large one. But the reality is
wine.
It's very much like wine. And in fact, wine and cheese have a lot of similarities in terms of how they went from being commodity products to highly valued, high involvement categories. And the wine industry was our forebearer 25 years ago. In the 70s, in the 80s, they were kind of showing a lot of the things they experienced are the things that we've experienced over the last 15 years.
Yeah. In 1945, you couldn't get me to eat American cheese.
Well,
my country was awash with orange cheddar from Canada and the United States, and I absolutely hated it.
Well, it's come a long way. Cheese in America has come a long way from what it was in the 40s, and it's certainly kind of the breadth and depth of what's being produced is pretty impressive, and now we're finding that American producers are finding offshore markets. There's a cheese that we love that's made in Dodgeville, Wisconsin, Pleasant Ridge Reserve, being sold in some of the finest cheese shops in Paris. So that's a great development.
Now, are there intermediaries in the cheese business, like Neil's Yard, for example, in London, where their business model is built on the fact that they will help finance the farmers who sell them their cheese because they'll act as the storage intermediary. So they'll take whole wheels, lots and lots of whole wheels of for example, fine cheddar, and they'll buy it from the farmer, but they won't sell it for several years so that it has a chance to mature to where it really can be. But
yes,
in the meantime, they
serve as amazing champions for cheesemakers in the British Isles, and they're also importing some of the American cheeses into the British Isles as well. So they're actually working hand in glove with us to develop markets for some of our products. In the United States, we have similar types of organizations, probably the most notable being the sellers of Jasper Hill Farm up in Vermont, which was a major investment, and it was something that the state of Vermont and a lot of people in our industry, they really put themselves out there and created a first-class facility, and the idea was to support a lot of the other producers, not just small ones, but also large ones like Cabot Creamery. Basically, the whole facility that they have and what they're all about has been to create a village kind of approach to supporting the industry. And now they'll bring in the cheese that some of these makers produce, age it, help find a market for it. And a lot of the smaller producers really have stayed in business because of that support.
I have another question. I worry about the FDA a lot.
Well, you and everybody else. Well, we just, we FDA is who we work with, and I have really good progress to report, actually. I'm sure everybody heard about the wood board aging issue that was that hit the airwaves about 3 or 4 months ago, and that really created a firestorm of public outcry, and actually legislators and the media and allied industry groups. I mean, because it affected everybody, producers of Parmigiano Reggiano and Comté, and even the smallest and largest producers. This was not a U.S. or import thing. It wasn't a small or large thing. It was everybody. So what we learned from that was there was a groundswell of goodwill for the industry, and the FDA, walked back their comments very quickly, 3 times in 72 hours.
Yep.
But what was the best thing that comes from it was that they reached out to us, and we had wanted to be working with them, but we were not having a lot of success. And their number two guy in the entire organization reached out and brought a delegation of 7 to our conference in Sacramento. We met, our leadership of ACS met with them for 3 hours the day before the conference, and then Mike Taylor, the deputy commissioner, he addressed our entire organization, over 1,000 people, at our business luncheon the next day, and he was very engaging and very sincere in his desire to take things forward in working more collaboratively. So there are a lot of issues out there right now, and we are following up on the goodwill that came from that, but the proof will be in the pudding over the next months. And we have a lot of work to do because there's a number of different traditional cheese-making methods which are, in danger.
Oh, no.
There are things that sometimes your individual inspector comes and you're not sure what it is that they're looking for, and they're not always as forthcoming as they could be. And so what we're trying to do is say, hey, let's have a dialogue, a true dialogue, and discuss what's going on and be more proactive. So they've agreed to meet with us multiple times a year face-to-face. We've exchanged phone numbers, and we're going to, when we have issues in the moment that we need to resolve, we're reaching out, and we're taking them at their word.
Well, that's wonderful.
Now, there must be a website where people can go to get more valuable insights about cheese.
Absolutely. Well, ACS's website is cheesesociety.org. And whenever we get information, we're putting it up there, and we're also doing member alerts. Our feeling is as soon as we have information that is of value to our members, and also it has a lot of resources on it. We have a whole body of knowledge of research that we have coalesced, that we've spent the last 5 years pulling together, that brings knowledge from all over the world, so people can find that. Also, we have we're working on a best practices for cheesemakers. And the FDA is reviewing that with us to make sure that it's going down the right path.
Great. Well,
I tell you, wonderful work.
You must make us a promise that as you get further along and you have more success to report in how the FDA is helping rather than hindering in the cheese-making process. And there's a whole other subject that I want to talk to you about, and we shouldn't do that today, which is the other side of the equation, which is how should people store their cheese when they buy some so that it doesn't spoil or it doesn't get too hard before they finish it.
But that's a long discussion. But
that's too big a subject for today.
It is. But the short answer is buy less and buy it more often.
Exactly.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a good
You've
life.
Been a delight, Greg. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And we'll be right back with some very special cheeses from Pennsylvania right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We were very pleased to see, since the cheese industry, the artisan cheese industry is sort of in a nascent state at this point in Pennsylvania, that we did have winners in the awards from the American Cheese Society, and when we sample these cheeses, we know why. Next up, we have Matt Hettliger and Samuel Kennedy from the farm at Doe's Run that makes Splendifico cheese. Every year I get excited about the American Cheese Society's annual awards, and this year was particularly exciting because we have a neighbor practically in Pennsylvania who won one of the awards, and not the usual customer, I would guess you'd say. You were not totally new to the business. We're talking to Matt Hefflinger and Samuel Kennedy of the farm at Doe Run. But you're not one of these old timers that's been winning the Cheese Society Award year after year after year. And you came out of the gate with a smashing cheese. Tell us about it.
So, yeah, this year we won the second place ribbon in the farmstead category, aged under 60 days, and that covered all milks for our Dragonfly, which is a Neufchâtel-style cheese that is derived in France, in the Normandy region of France. So it's aged under 60 days, really something that I've been working on personally for about 2.5 years now, and me and Matt have been working on personally since I've gotten here. So it's really made leaps and bounds since I got the food science mind on it of Matt. So it's a,
he's a scientist.
What great teamwork can do.
So Matt is a food scientist. Let's start with, where are you exactly? Where is this farm?
We are located just west of Philadelphia, about 40 minutes. If you're familiar with the area, we're north of Kennett Square and south of Coatesville. And we're located right in horse country. There's quite a few farms and large estates that are in the area. And
you've got an extensive block of land and a gentleman farmer owner, and you've got a flock, herds, plural, that would be the envy of a veteran cheesemaker. You must be really set to have a great time.
We are. Really, it's about, we're given all the avenues to just be creative as possible, and having the cow, you know, our Jersey cows, and then our sheep herd, and then the goat herd just really makes the limitations endless.
Those goats are supposed to be fun.
Possible, you know, everything is possible for us. So,
now
really interesting and exciting for next year.
Now, this year's cheeses were cow cheeses, but you're going to be producing goat next year. And tell me, let's go back here. Sam, you said Matt is the food scientist. Now, Matt, what does that mean?
I have a degree from Ohio State in food science, and I went a little bit different path than some of the people I graduated with. Sam and I both worked in restaurants before. Sam is a chef. I went and studied food science for several years and got into artisan cheesemaking because I really enjoy the science behind it, and I really enjoy working with my hands, too, so cheesemaking is the best of both worlds, and then having someone like Sam as part of the team who's a very good technical cheesemaker, and I can offer some insight into science behind it, we make a really, really good team.
Now, you mentioned that the Dragonfly is, I think you call it the Neufchâtel style,
yes,
from Normandy, so it's a soft cheese, but it's a soft cheese as characterized in a particular region of France. Now, you make a number of other cheeses. Are they also modeled after classic European cheeses?
We do. We do model after European cheeses, but one of the things, and Sam might actually differ with me on this, is the Europeans have several hundred years of head start on these cheeses. For us, we want to make really good American cheeses, and we'll model some of our cheeses after, closely tied to some of the recipes of the old world, but we also want to put our twist on it. And I'm sure Sam feels the same way, but he's... he does follow the recipes a little bit closer than I do.
Can we get an idea of, of the kind of a differences that you're bringing to bear, so that things that you might call distinctly American?
There's terroir just to start with.
Well, exactly, because we're farmstead. We have the animals out eating.
Yeah, mine is
basically 99% of their diet this time of year is grass.
Yeah, I mean, farmstead means that they're your own animals.
Our own animals, and then the cheese that we're making is from our own milk. We're not bringing in any other outsourced.
That's a very important difference. Go ahead.
Being farmstead gives us really a great flavor of the land. But, it's really interesting because the same can be said about the same correlations can be made between American wine or New World wines versus Old World wines, and it's the same with New World cheese versus Old World cheese. I love the, in America, cheeses are typically a little more nutty, a little more fruity, a little more sweet in their flavor profile, where just like the classic wines of Europe, the European cheeses are a little more mineralistic, a little more wet rock and those flavor notes. I mean, you can taste it in the Appenzeller or the Hickory on the Hill, which is our Appenzeller style. It's a little fruity, it's creamy, it's buttery, but then if you get a piece of nice Appenzeller from Switzerland, it's a little more mineralistic forward than the fruit notes.
Got it. Now, what about Hickory on the Hill?
That would be the Appenzeller.
So that's the Appenzeller. That's the Appenzeller. Okay,
our twist on that one is using locally roasted coffee, and then that's also washed with black cardamom and coriander.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's interesting.
Well, you know, one of the great secrets of Appenzeller is the wash that they use, or the recipe for the wash. It's under guarded lock and key. So it's really nice that we get to play around in our own way with that wash style.
Yeah, it looks kind of dirty on the outside, right?
It is, yeah. It kind of has, nice tan color to it.
Now, are you supposed to eat that? I eat most rinds, but then I think somebody told me you really weren't supposed to, so I did cut the rind off. We still have plenty of left.
That one you definitely can. That definitely adds some flavor, and you do pick up a little bit of the coffee and a little bit of the cardamom, and it's subtle, but it adds definitely a little bit more flavor on the rind. We're very happy with how it's turned out.
And Seven Sisters, the Jersey cow, gets pride of place on the label.
Yes, that's actually, so the Seven Sisters name was named after the first seven cows that we brought on the farm. So they were Seven Sisters, and this was one of the first cheeses that we made here. We've changed the recipe a little bit over the years, but something that's very similar to a Gouda. And like I said, but we put our own twist on it because the Jersey milk is a little bit different than what they would use in the Netherlands.
And how big a production do you have going right now?
We're milking 15 cows, so we're getting about 160 gallons a day of milk, and that's producing about 140 pounds of cheese, 160 pounds of cheese a day for us. So we're making, we'll probably top off at 20,000 pounds this year.
But the demand has jumped, I understand, especially Dragonfly. It's hard to keep up with the demand.
It is, especially for such a small farm that's not truly focused on the production aspect of the cheese world. It's more focused on the quality aspect. So we're very small batch as what else is considered in the cheese world.
Do you have lauded out, like, what cheeses you're planning on next? Like, you must have a whole new ball game opening up with the goat's milk.
We do. We've discussed, we've actually made some prototypes and followed some recipes using our cow's milk. So we're going to see how those translate early in the year once we start using sheep and goat's milk for those recipes. So we do have an idea of what we're going to do. And, the cheese, like the Hummingbird, was typically made with a mixed, has been made before with a mixed sheep and cow's milk. So a lot of our sheep's milk will go to that. We're talking about, we have another cheese that Sam can probably tell you about a little bit more, that's a prototype called Blowhorn, and that's based on a Chef de Terre and Taste style that we'll be doing with goat's milk next year.
Yeah, tell us a little bit more about that, and then if you have any plans to make a blue cheese, which is my greatest weakness.
The Blowhorn, so Matt was saying, the Blowhorn is a Chef de Terre and Taste style. So it's really a style that is rarely found in this country. It's an acid rennet coagulated cheese, so it's going to have that same texture as what the Dragonfly is, but it's much firmer. It's actually aged on our end about a minimum of a month. It can be anywhere up to, I'm going to guess on this one, up to 3 months on that. And, it's going to be a little drum. It kind of has this nice brainy looking rind to it, part bloomy, part natural rind. So it'll be really interesting. It picks up some really nice mineral notes from our caves.
So it's
much more akin to what I would think would be the European style.
So it's going to look like sort of those pyramids of goat cheese.
It'll be a barrel. So but it'll have that same kind of brainy look to it as the pyramids.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
Now, one of the other big winners, oh, now I can't remember the name from the...
Vermont Creamery.
No. Well, the Vermont Creamery is always a winner.
She does a good job there, so...
Oh, she's Allison's fabulous. Yeah. We've interviewed her a number of times, recently.
They won 7 awards, which sounded kind of greedy.
But, now, what was this? Oh, yes, one of the other winners is the first... And it said the press release I got, long-term organic certified cheeses won a big award, and I can't remember the name of it. But you don't hear that so much about the winners in the Cheese Society, about this organic issue. Natural, yes, but organic? I mean, do you have any ambitions in that direction?
We do follow a pretty organic style of farming. We don't use hormones on our animals. We don't spray with unnatural fertilizers or synthetic man-made products, insecticides, pesticides, fertilizers. So really, we're going the extra length as an organic farm, but we don't really have the ambition to be certified because it does limit you to what you can use on your animal.
Uh-huh.
So if one of our girls that are beloved to us does happen to come down with something, we are limited to what we can use on her.
Aww.
When we're organic certified. So it's one of those double-edged swords in the industry, so to speak.
Oh, you probably don't make enough milk to get into other cultured products, such as cultured butters, huh?
No, and that does take some specialized equipment to do the cultured butters and yogurt and, creme fraiches and cottage cheeses. And then it also does take a different level of certified facility.
Oh, you do? I know Allison has...
She's grade A up there, yes. We're actually a grade B facility, or would be considered a grade B facility. So we're completely certified to do cheese processing,
mm-hmm.
but we wouldn't be able to sell liquid milk. We wouldn't be able to sell yogurts and the cultured milk products, the fermented milk products like kefir and quark and...
Yeah.
And those.
Yeah, who's that woman that does the, we had her buttermilk, what's her name? She supplies the French Laundry and Barbara Lynch.
Mm-hmm. Out of
Vermont, isn't she?
I believe she's Maine.
Maine. You're right, she's Maine.
I know exactly who you're talking about, but her name is slipping my mind right now.
She just wrote a cookbook even about her buttermilk recipes.
Yeah, she does
That's
a really phenomenal buttermilk. When I was a chef on Martha's Vineyard last year, and we used her products, and they were just absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah.
Right, now
same with Vermont Creamery. From a professional culinary aspect, there's nothing better than their creme fraiche, than their butters. They really do deserve those honors in the American Cheese Society.
Right. Now, you're actually part of some kind of a group called Chester County Cheese, the ChesterCountyCheese.org?
Yes, the Chester County Cheese Artisans. So the Chester County Cheese Artisans are a group of small cheesemakers, all from Chester County at the moment. There's about 7 or 8 of us in the group at the moment. But we are looking to expand. We're starting to toy around with the idea of allowing other Pennsylvania cheesemakers into the group with us. And coming from outside of the state and now being newly thrown into the Chester County Cheese Artisans Guild, it's really nice to have the camaraderie.
Yeah, I was
really
going
nice
to say, we find that with cheesemakers a lot.
Yeah, well, I think it's the nature of cheese. It's that kind of product. It's a word-of-mouth industry. It only in the last 30 years, 40 years, did it really become scientifically driven. Most cheesemakers do what they do because that's what they were taught to do.
And a lot of us do different things. So we're not really stepping on each other's toes in terms of what cheese we're making.
Right.
And the way that I look at it, and I think Sam feels the same way, is as long as people are still eating Velveeta out there, we still have a job to do. So,
right.
Spread the word about good cheese.
Does the Chester County Cheese Organization help with distribution as well? I noticed we have a couple of pages out of their website, and it shows where Chester County cheeses can be bought, like Wild Purveyors in Pittsburgh and East End Food Co-op in Pittsburgh.
Those two locations do a really good job for us in Pittsburgh. As far as all of the cheesemakers selling their product. We don't have a central distribution.
Oh, you
for
don't?
That.
Okay. All right.
Well, how did
that's been something in the works. We've talked about that, but not currently.
Okay. It's more of a promotional or a cooperative marketing endeavor.
Got it, got it. But it's ChesterCountyCheese.org is that organization. And your website is what?
The only website we have would be through that. We kind of try to stay under the radar. And you can also reach us on Facebook at the Farm at Doe Run.
As well as Instagram as well.
Well, how do people get your cheese?
You know, locations, we have distributors in Philadelphia and New York. And
places here, right?
A couple places in Pittsburgh. Two that you mentioned, a couple places in Chicago.
But not through the website.
The website. If someone's interested in the cheese, they can contact us through our email or through Facebook.
Well, you sound like you're having a great time.
We do. It's uncanny how well of a team was put together for us. It was really newfound friendships between us. Families get along. It's really fun to go to work.
Yeah,
and you can't ever complain about that.
And I think making cheese is about as close to working magic as you can get.
It's very true.
There's some magic involved.
Yes, I think so too. So, well, I just wish you all kinds of success. And don't forget that we knew you when you won't answer emails or something. Or you're too busy, rather, to answer emails. Keep us in mind as early proponents of your brand.
Oh, we will. We will always have a tour spot open for you guys.
Thank you.
Okay.
We appreciate you having us.
And maybe we'll come see the farm sometime, huh?
Absolutely.
Wouldn't that be fun? Okay, well, thank you both again. And as I said, good luck, Matt Ettlinger and Samuel Kennedy and the farm at Doe Run.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
What more quintessentially American food is there in the summertime than
Maine lobster. Yum, yum, yum.
And
yum, yum.
Thanks to the Maine Lobster Association, I forget the
Marketing
full name of it.
Marketing Cooperative.
They decided not only would they like to talk to us, but they'd also like us to taste some lobster. So we went along with both of those things, and of course the lobster was delicious.
And we talked to Marianne Lacroix,
who was
to tell us all about the mission of this wonderful organization.
And she's a wonderful spokesperson. You'll want to rush out and buy some just as soon as this interview's over.
Peter, you keep remembering our fabulous lobster feast the other day, which was our very first encounter with so-called soft shell or new shell lobster. And we can explore the whole subject of lobster today with Marianne Lacroix. Oh, you don't pronounce it that way, do you, Marianne?
I don't, but that's fine.
you are acting executive director of this wonderful organization called the Maine Lobster Marketing Cooperative. Is that correct?
Collaborative.
Collaborative. I knew I'd get that wrong. So what is this organization?
This is an organization that was started by the industry itself, and the lobstermen and lobster dealers, lobster processors, all pay an annual surcharge in order to market their product altogether. And our organization does that marketing for them.
Oh, well, that's good. All right. And when was it instituted or formed?
Well, it was actually just formed last year and replaced an organization called the Maine Lobster Promotion Council that had been in place for 20 years that formed a similar function.
Uh-huh. Now, when we were talking before about lobsters are fairly complicated, even though as an animal they're fairly simple, right?
Yes.
We had the soft shells and the new shells. How you got our attention was you were talking about the need for chefs to approach lobsters from different directions in preparation. Is that an issue?
Well, certainly there are different kinds of lobsters on the market. With the soft shells that you're talking about, there's that's a time of the year when the shell is softer, the meat is very flavorful, it's very sweet, the texture is very tender, and that's a great opportunity for chefs to use product and to bring out those flavors, not to mask them with other heavy accompaniments.
Ours were very cute, and they were very shy.
and they were very empty when they were done.
But shipping lobsters is fairly complicated. Now, ours came from Door Lobster Company, which I went online and found out they're really a major supplier.
Yes, and they ship, as many companies do, they ship both to consumers so that consumers can order lobster from companies. We have a list of companies on our website, lobsterfrommaine.com, and you can go in, check a list of different companies that will ship lobster direct to your door. And, of course, then there's a big wholesale market that are supplying restaurants and grocery stores around the country and even around the world, actually.
Now, there's been a lot of going around about the current lobster market. Now, from my understanding, sustainability is kind of a built-in characteristic of lobster production. Could you talk about that?
Sure. It is here in Maine, and it's really amazing because it's such a long history of it. So way back over almost 150 years ago, when the fishermen were fishing, they realized the importance of sustaining the resource in order to make sure it's there for future generations. So they started the 1800s protecting the egg-bearing females. So if a lobster came up with eggs, it'd throw it back in. And obviously that's a very important thing to make sure that there's more little lobsters being born in the ocean. And they even added a step a few years later to V-notch the tail. So if the fishermen pull out a lobster that has eggs on its tail and they're visible on the tail, they'll cut a little V-notch in one of its tail flippers and throw it back in, and then that lobster's protected. It's marked as a good breeder and protected even from being caught in the future. So the next fisherman that pulls it up, if it has a V-notch, he has to throw it back even if there's no eggs on the tail.
Now, it's interesting you should say that, because the New England fishing industry in general is not known for being very good at sustainability. I was just reading a story this morning that cod, which was the staple of the fishing industry in the Georges Banks and that whole area, that the rate of decline, I forget how they measured it, has continued rapidly, and pretty soon North Atlantic cod caught in United States waters won't be an endangered species, it will be a gone species.
Yeah, and the trajectory of the lobster is very different from that of the cod, where in the past 20 years we've seen quite a dramatic increase in the number of lobsters coming in. And the cod that you mentioned, they're a predator of small lobsters. So the decrease in the cod could certainly be one of the factors that helped the lobster population to be able to increase.
Yeah, but we don't want cod to go away, do we?
Not at all. Not at all. I'm hoping that we'll come back. And there's obviously measures in place now to help bring that fishery back.
Well, you mentioned this supply and demand thing. I was reading where fishermen don't even bother going out, taking their boats out to fish lobsters, to catch lobsters, because the cost, price they're paid per pound is so low. But yet, where we are, and every place probably outside of Maine, the price remains high and out of most people's reach.
Right. Well, the price this year is fairly stable, which is good news for the fishermen. So we see a lot of buoys out there and a lot of boats out fishing. So we won't know what the annual price is, obviously, until the end of the season, but it looks fairly good right now. But the shipping cost is such a huge part of the cost of product going outside of Maine and New England, that's what consumers are paying for a lot of times. Whether it's FedEx directly to you or whether you're buying in a store, it still has travel costs, and there are obviously expenses associated with shipping a live product.
Oh, yeah. Ours came beautifully wrapped. They were happy in wet towels and ice. And
well, we think they were.
I think they're happy.
We asked them if they had any complaints, and they didn't say anything.
A good sign.
Tell me, what is today's lobster fisherman like? I know, reading about the personalities, actually, historically, they were made out to be kind of eccentric but colorful characters. I mean, who's a lobster fisherman today?
Well, it's interesting. We have over 5,000 licensed lobstermen in the state, so there's a big range, and there's kids as young as 7 or 8 that have their commercial fishing license, and people, you know, up into their 90s that still have their commercial fishing license. There's both men and women doing it, so it's really like any other profession. It's a range, but obviously it's people who enjoy being out on the water, being outdoors, they're all independent businessmen. In Maine, we can't have any corporations that own boats and license them out. The fisherman has to own his boat and own his traps and have the license, so it's all small businessmen. So it's really people, I think, that are independent and enjoy, you know, being out on the water.
Now, they still use the traditional boats.
Yes, it hasn't changed very much. They're using wire now instead of wood for the most part.
Okay.
It's a little bit more durable, but it's a very similar construction that's been in place for over 100 years where the lobster walks into the trap to get the bait, and they actually can get out again, so it's really the ones that are in the trap when you pull it up that you see on your dinner plate.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Here's a question. How is it decided where people will set their traps? I mean, is it just handed down from generation to generation, or do you apply for a license to put your pots in one particular place? How does that work?
Well, on a broad sense, there are 7 fishing zones along the coast, so you'll get a license to fish in one zone. So you'll have to put those within your own zone. But then within that zone, it's really a matter of certainly people have their spots where they've put their traps historically, and if you're a newcomer into the industry, people let you know if you're, you know, encroaching on somebody else's territory, but there is no official designation about where traps go.
Okay, so if you're a new person then, and you put your pots in the wrong place, all of a sudden you're going to find that they're not there anymore.
They might still be there, but the buoy will be gone, so you wouldn't be able to find them.
that's a good clue, hint.
is there a particular reason why lobsters off the coast of Maine, why there are so many of them and there aren't in other parts of the country, off other shores?
Well, this is its traditional spot. It's a good environment for lobsters to grow. We've got a lot of rocky nooks that lobsters like for breeding and reproducing. The water temperature is ideal for lobsters. They have kind of a range of temperatures that they're comfortable in, so too warm water they don't like, and, you know, too cold they don't like. So we're in the range that's ideal for breeding and growing lobsters, and the right rocky environment as well.
But, you know, isn't that changing with climate change? I mean, I know it's affecting crabs in the Chesapeake Bay.
And certainly that could be one of the reasons that we're seeing fewer even in southern New England now than we used to.
Oh, I thought we were seeing lots more. I didn't think we were. Are you talking about lobsters or crabs?
There's fewer lobsters in southern New England.
Oh,
we certainly have a lot more here in Maine.
So that,
okay.
Southern New England would be Massachusetts and Connecticut.
In New York, right?
Okay.
In New England and New York, yes.
So you need to buy your lobsters from Maine because they got nice cold water there.
Yeah, and we're harvesting about 85% of the lobsters that are caught in the United States.
Oh, wow.
In Maine.
Okay, so it's not like anybody else has much of a share, huh?
Right.
Well, how many is that? I mean, 85%.
Well, last year we caught just over 125 million pounds of lobster.
Jeez, wow.
That's a lot, huh?
Yeah.
That's a lot.
How did lobster go from being something they fed people in prison to a luxury item?
Well, the shipping really changed that once people were able to get it. The canneries actually were the first ones, you know, people started canning lobster and people got a taste for it. And then with air shipping, it was able to go live. So it was just... became a luxury item, I think, anything that's a little bit rare. And historically, Maine's only harvested about 20 to 25 million pounds of lobster per year, so it was a fairly rare product.
So how often do you eat lobster?
Oh, a couple times a week.
Oh, you poor thing.
I actually have one of my kids complaining that we have it too much, so.
Really?
Now, do you have it for breakfast, lunch, and dinner?
I don't have it for breakfast very much, but certainly lunch and dinner. We're big fans of lobster rolls in our house. We like the picked meat that's easy, you know, just buying it here, and that's a lot of the fish shops here do sell the picked meat, which is very easy.
Yeah, I mean, I remember trying to find an authentic lobster shack in Portland when we were there, And we had a hard time finding something that was really authentic, traditional.
Yeah, we finished up fairly far south, somewhere near Freeport.
Oh, sure. That's where I live, in Freeport. So we do have a list of lobster shacks on our website now, because we do get that question quite a lot. So we put together a list of the ones that the locals go to, and it's on our website.
Oh, good. Okay, so that's handy. Now, we were visiting the people from Cold River Vodka and Gin.
Oh, sure.
And we asked them where to go.
I bet they sent you down to Hairseek at Lunch and Lobster.
I'm sure they probably did. I remember there was a long line.
Yes, yeah, they're always busy.
Yeah,
the good
right.
ones always are.
Yeah. Well, I think you have an important mission. I don't know what happens if you sell lobsters for different preparations to too many chefs, because then it's just going to throw the balance of how many lobsters are left for the rest of us off.
Well, right now it seems like there's enough for everybody, so we're in pretty good shape.
Okay, well, I thank you for talking to us, and I understand you're getting a new executive director, so we're going to see a lot of fireworks happening there, are we?
Yes, we are. We're going to be doing a lot of marketing going forward. We're partnering with different culinary organizations, and really our goal is just to teach people about lobster, how to cook it, how to prepare it, you know, what to do with it when you get it, and we just want to be a resource for both consumers and the trade.
The worst experience I had was friends of mine in Indianapolis. I was visiting, and it was going to be my birthday, and they decided to order Maine lobsters for me.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got there, I found out that when the lobsters arrived, they filled the bathtub up with water and put the lobsters in.
Oh, it's such a common mistake. You're thinking these are sea creatures. They need to be in the water, but they cannot live in fresh water. And
well,
it's actually a problem, too.
Chlorinated water now.
Chlorinated, no, that's terrible. And we see that problem sometimes when people put them in ice in a cooler, and then the ice melts, and same result.
Oh, dear. Well, it's been a delight talking to you about probably one of my most favorite foods, Marianne.
Oh, good.
and good luck with your new director and with your flourishing organization.
Thank you. Thanks for having me today.
And may there be many more years of many more lobsters.
Thank you. That's a very good wish.
And don't worry, because you'll be able to quench your thirst with us after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And heading down the home stretch of today's program, something to quench your thirst, that's an old-fashioned but a newfangled drink. You never guessed it, it's cider, and cider being made by two really interesting young men who call themselves the Cider Brothers. And they are...
Well, we're going to be talking to one of the brothers, Paul Scotto.
Okay.
And all about as you say, it's an old... drink. In Europe, it never fell out of favor, but in America, we have a revival of interest in this product.
I think they said consumption up 40% last year.
Yeah, it's
year
a,
on
it's
year.
Really going up.
So it's hot. If you haven't tried it recently, these are fine products that will palate wise go with lots and lots of different foods.
You could probably drink it with
lobster.
Yeah,
undoubtedly.
Especially the dry one.
Undoubtedly would go very well with lobster. So. Here we are talking cider.
Well, we've just learned that Paul Scotto, who is one of the Cider Brothers, wears many, many different hats. Paul, your brother is Michael?
Yes.
Yes. And you're fifth generation winemakers in your family wine business. And you also, you said a year and a half ago, moved on to producing ciders.
Yes.
This is, as far as I'm concerned, is a very major trend, even attacking the craft beer trend. And I think that it's becoming ever more popular, and the products being made are just absolutely the highest of quality. Tell me, you know about the history of cider. It's not new in most parts of the world. It's new to America, but it has never stopped being a tradition. I mean, I'm thinking of Basque Country. Do you have an elevator speech on the history of cider?
So, I mean, the hard apple cider, a lot of people think it's a new trend. It's really not. I mean, back in the 1800s, that was the drink of choice. And people at that time were drinking cider rather than drinking water because they felt it was cleaner because it went through fermentation. And everybody had cider at their house. And then when Prohibition came around, a lot of the cider trees were pulled out. So it really put a halt on the cider industry in California, or in, not California, in the U.S. And then after Prohibition ended, it was easier for people to get back into making beer than it was to making cider.
Uh-huh.
And finally now, it's finally coming back around where it's revived. I think it's coming back to life. Some people think it's just a trend coming, but I believe it's in for the long haul. It's going to be another beverage that's here that people are going to be drinking.
Yeah, we had somebody else we talked to about cider who said that basically cider is really ancient.
Because
everybody had apples.
Yes.
And if you couldn't eat all the apples, you might as well do something with them.
Yeah, I mean, in the history, I mean, you look back to the Romans, the Greeks, and the Egyptians, there's all kinds of write-ups about them drinking a fermented apple juice.
So that's basically cider is fermented apple juice, just like wine is fermented grape juice. But you tend to intermingle those two, don't you? You were talking to us earlier about blending wine into cider. Tell us about that.
So for me, you know, I've played with a lot of different wine varietals. I've used lots of different yeasts, anything from a sweet wine to dry wine, white and red. And then seeing the trend of cider right now and all the different people using different types of juice to blend in with their ciders, cherry, strawberry, blueberry, whatever it is, I wanted to do something different. And I'm looking around the winery, and I'm looking at all my tanks here thinking, I've got Pinot Grigio, I've got Sauvignon Blanc, I've got Muscat. You know, what the heck? Let's try and see how it's going to taste if I blend a little bit of wine back into the cider. So I started playing with different varietals, Muscat, Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Grigio, and percentages, and finally found out from my taste, and then I started having other people taste it, that the Pinot Grigio complemented the cider the best. And I think one of the main reasons is it has the right amount of acidity, but at the same time, it's still a fruity and fragrant varietal in the wine. As for wine.
Now, is this being done anywhere else in the world that you know of? I mean, there are regions of the world where there are lots of apples and there are lots of grapes. Has anybody done it before, or were you the first, do you think?
Looking in the research that I've been doing, I have not found any other cider maker that's blending a specific varietal with the apple cider.
Interesting.
I've researched, but I can't find anything. So I don't want to claim to be the first, because I'm not 100% sure, but I think I am.
What is this frost fermentation you're known for?
So it's been a learning curve for me, and one of the key components in making a good apple cider is being able to have control of the temperature. So I treat it like I'm making a Sauvignon Blanc or Pinot Grigio, and when I do that, I bring the juice in, I cool it down with dry ice or with the wine, the grapes, before we crush it, and keep everything cold. So with the cider, it's fresh pressed up in Washington, we'll say on a Tuesday. By late Thursday, early Friday, I will have that juice to me down in Lodi. And when it comes in, it arrives in at about 37 degrees temperature. So then I prep everything, get everything ready for fermentation. So once it's done fermenting, once I feel it's dry, I turn the temperature down from the chiller from about 55 to 65 degrees. I drop the temperature all the way down to typically about 30 degrees. So by accident, what happened when I did that, I went to rack the tank off, and my tank, the inside of the tank that I racked from, was completely covered in frost.
Oh, wow.
So what it ended up doing was freezing some of the water off of the fermented juice.
Now, the funny thing is, in northern Vermont,
Yeah, I was just thinking of them.
And in southern Canada, there's a tradition of making what they call ice cider.
And, oh, really?
And they actually pick the apples, and they leave the apples outside to freeze over the winter. And then, after the ice melts, they let the water run away, but the alcohol that remains behind in the apples is much more concentrated. So as a result, they get something that's approaching the alcohol of a light wine. They're getting like 10 or 11% alcohol without really doing anything other than being patient.
Yes, being very patient, I'm sure. I'm sitting there watching their apples freeze.
Well, it's like grass growing. I guess you don't actually have to watch it. you can just sort of leave it alone.
Well, you're always exploring. What do you look to doing next? I mean, you're blending wine now also. And
so for me right now, I mean, the way my family works and the way we've been in the wine industry, we are not too attached to our products, and we don't take criticism in a bad way. We take what the market, what the people or the customers are saying in the market, and we try to create and get them what they want. And so right now, since we've just started distributing in the last 2.5 months, we're really listening to all of our distributors and the consumers to seeing what they want next. The Pinot Grigio apple, the apple Pinot Grigio has really taken off. That's been our number one seller. So now I've been starting to think about other wines that I could potentially blend with it. And my ciders right now are dry, so I've been thinking about doing a sweeter cider with a muscat.
Uh-huh. That would do it, yeah.
Well, that'd be interesting because you'll be getting more of the sweetness from the muscat and less from the apples.
Yes, especially when I'm fermenting the apples, I ferment it dry.
Now, it sounded to me, as we were talking earlier on, you said you buy your apples, essentially you're actually buying the juice in the state of Washington, but you're using apples, you said, like Granny Smith, which are not nearly traditional cider apples.
No. So,
here's a list of them. Golden Russet, Granny Smith, Gallus, Fuji's, and Red Delicious.
Right, and none of those are traditional cider apples.
Correct. I think the one that's closest being used maybe now as a cider apple, sometimes a little bit of the Golden Russet. I know the Granny Smiths, I work with the juicing company, and I give them kind of my, the numbers, the chemical numbers where I would like the pH, the Brix, and the total acidity to be before I get the juice. Mm-hmm. And with the numbers that I give them, Granny Smith has to be a biggest part of
that's amazing because as we were talking before we came on the air, Granny Smiths are actually a warm climate apple, developed by a Mrs. Smith in Randwick, New South Wales, a suburb of Sydney, back in the 1700s or early 1800s, and she blended to create an apple that would grow in a climate which is essentially subtropical.
That's a piece of knowledge I'm going to use.
So there you go. And it's interesting because it's a rather tart apple, isn't it?
Yes, yes. And you know what? One of the biggest differences, and you, Peter, I'm sure you know, with the cider apple versus the eating apple is the tannin.
Well, cider apples are essentially uneatable.
Yes.
Because they're sour.
Yes. So, and that's why I asked for the majority of the blend to be the Granny Smith. As you probably know, here in the U.S., because of what happened in Prohibition and a lot of the cider apples were pulled out, there are not that many out there. So the cider apple juice and the cider apple orchards are limited right now. And to be able to produce a large amount of cider for all, you know, combined with all the different cideries out there, there's really not enough cider apples to go around.
Right, so you're essentially experimenting, partly because of a supply issue, partly I'm guessing because you're very pleased with the results, and so are your customers.
Yes. Yes, and some people, you know, without knowing the story and not without knowing the apples I'm using, have compared mine to some of the other cider companies that are producing their juice from 100% cider apples, and they ask me, how the heck are you making it taste like that without using cider apples?
There you go. Now, so your experiment has been successful so far.
I believe so. I mean, I've been happy, and a lot of the consumers out there have been very happy with our product.
What do you do about effervescence? We had some cider from another company that was almost like a champagne. It was bubbly. Okay. And then in Basque Country in northern Spain, they actually have a little ritual of pouring the cider from way up high into the glass so it kind of aerates along the way when they're pouring it.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you say that, Anne, because I'm known at my tasting room, which I call the long pour, but on my website, my Serafina Cellars website for my winery, you'll see me doing long pours with wine in the glasses.
And that's what it is.
But with the cider, that's been the biggest learning curve for me because I haven't worked that much with carbonation.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the one piece of equipment that I had to purchase to really start to produce cider was the bright tanks. And the bright tanks are different from the wine tanks because the bright tanks are able to withstand pressure. So my cider is forced carbonated with CO2. And in order to successfully do that, you have to be able to get the temperature of the cider down to about, I like to get it down to about 34 degrees.
Wow.
Okay, so you're not creating a sparkling cider with a champagne method kind of production.
No.
Forced carbon. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, but you can.
So,
I mean, there are people who are doing that, right?
Yes, there are people doing that.
We
don't have the equipment or the time to be able to create that. And I'm trying to produce a clean product, which is consumer doesn't have to worry about any yeast floating at the bottom out of the glass when they get it. It'll be a clean product. It'll be crisp. And that's kind of the profile I've been going for.
And you predict that if not overtaking, at least cider production and consumption in the United States is going to be well on the heels of the craft beer movement, huh?
Well, no, right now, I mean, it's far behind the craft beer. It's
I mean,
far
eventually.
Beer. So right now, it's a PowerPoint presentation that I learned about at the cider conference last year. With all alcohol being consumed, cider is about 1%, which is very small. But with that being said, in 2013, cider sales were up 64%. Some say 68, anywhere between 64 and 70% in 2013.
Wow.
So cider is right now the number one growing alcohol beverage in the U.S.
Now, you mentioned your website. How about if you spell the website out for our listeners?
Okay, so my cider website is www.ciderbrothers.com. That is ciderbrothers.com.
Right.
That is my cider site. And my wine site for you wine lovers out there is www.serafinacellars, and that's SERAFINACELLARS.com.
How do you get this cider? How does one
get it? So right now, I am working. Well, one, they can go to our website and send out an email, and I'll respond, or I'll have one of my girls respond on, depending on the state they're in, on where they can purchase it.
Yep.
But in Pennsylvania right now, we're just finalizing a deal right now with a distributor to start distributing into Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
But Pennsylvania doesn't make things easy.
Tell me about it.
I know. We will tell you off the air how it's possible for you to be able to communicate your beverages with us, and it doesn't have anything to do with the PLCB.
Wow, that's great. That'd be great.
But anyhow, you're in the United States exclusively.
Yes.
Okay.
And right now I could tell you, I mean, we're live and distributing in California, Montana, Arizona, Texas, South Carolina, Illinois, and about to launch right now into Oregon, Washington, and Alaska.
Wow. Well, that's good. Very good.
Well, you must come back and see us in a couple of years and see if your projection about the continued growth, or we should probably call it the regrowth of cider, continues. And in the meantime, thank you so much for joining us and bringing your very interesting story to our On the Menu listeners.
And Peter, I've got one other fun fact for you.
Go ahead.
That Granny Smith one. Do you know the top three apple-consuming countries are in the world?
I don't.
The number one is actually Turkey.
Oh, wow.
Turkey.
And, wow. Actually, sorry, the number one is China. The number two is Turkey, and the number three is the United States.
There you go. So, wow. So we believe in apples.
Yes, America believes in apples.
Well, they believe that old thing about the apple. An apple for the teacher will keep you out of trouble.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it was
great talking to you.
Yeah, it was so much fun. So we hope you enjoyed this All-American program and that you'll join us again, same time, same place, next week.
Bye-bye.